something you talked about at the talk as well, that you know, you see yourself as several distinct, I don't want to say people, but there are several distinct elements of yourself when you're creating. There's the writer, there's the artist, and I think you also the letterer as well, that and how you go about creating these parts in three totally different mindsets.
Oh yeah, you're right. I know what you mean. What I said that there's each of those is like a different. It's a different stage for me,
mm-hmm.
and each of those stages has a margin for spontaneity improvement too. And I will find myself in a totally different cycle through each of those processes.
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I'll kind of. I've been doing it long enough that I'll kind of know what cycle to be on for maximum efficiency for each of those. So I'll get on like a different sleeping and eating and exercise cycle, you know, from writing to drawing to the lettering part.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it'll change quite a bit. So maybe it is like different, you know, it's on what, maybe it is like you're a different person when you're on a different schedule from the others.
Mm-hmm.
But, and that was one of the things in the alchemy too. I've been doing this story for like 15 years. I've been working in comics for 15 years. I'd learned certain creative principles, certain principles that would help me maximize my creative output that were kind of encrypted in the story too, with
mm-hmm.
like the characters kind of learning about them or stumbling upon them or having epiphanies or discussing,
mm-hmm.
were certain things that just by trial and error I'd kind of figured out for my own work. So I let them kind of have their spot in the story with the characters, you know, in case that was helpful to anybody else, like it might have been with the characters.
Right, and that, well, and that gets to the bigger thing. When I was reading it, I really felt like the alchemy was a call to arms in the sense, in this, you know, war of art, that it was a real call to people to create something, to do something. And so seeing how you embedded this advice in there, and, you know, from the very early on with, you know, the person on the airplane having the conversation about childhood and drawing and just drawing what they wanted and just letting it go and all that freedom, to later on about, you know, sleep cycles and regulating the chemicals in your body that way.
Beyond that, the owning your past by just writing it down, those are all really interesting elements on the idea of creation.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have anything else that to comment about that?
I guess in the idea that you said, you know, creating is like a call to arms. Sometimes I have to put it that way to myself in order to get work done and work done in a timely way. You kind of have to, there's so many distractions,
mm-hmm.
and there's so many just on a daily level of just, you know, family stuff or other things that are out there that are going to be there that can change your state of mind. And you have to kind of give a context to it in a way that forces you to to not let those things turn your, even though they're going to happen, you got to deal with them. You can't let them change your state of mind in a negative way, or in a way where you use them as excuses not to still be productive at the same time. And you have to, it's difficult. There's a lot of self-discipline involved. So a lot of that book, a lot of those things came out of just, you know, probably 20 years of self-discipline and trying to figure out how to trick yourself into working, you know,
mm-hmm.
how to trick yourself into not procrastinating, and how to, because there's sort of like these, you know, I guess in this story, if there's an antagonist, there's kind of a twofold antagonist. There's the external forces outside,
mm-hmm.
that might seem to be, you know, some kind of pulling you away from what you think you're here to do. And then there's an internal resistance to that, which, you know, is labeled resistance in the book.
Mm-hmm.
There's a reference to the War of Art story by Pressfield that I had cited in the book, that there's this part of your mind that's always saying, like, well, this, you know, do this instead. You should eat now, or you should do this, or think of all the other things you got to do right now. Do that. And all of these things your mind is saying that makes that makes it sound a lot easier to do that than to just really sit there and focus and make something happen. In any, not just writing or art, but in anything you're going to do, mm-hmm. you know, whatever it's going to be. And it's always there. You know, it never disappears. You just always have to find ways to conquer that part of you, mm-hmm. you know, and make that work. And that I had to put it in a very, I don't know if it's a simplified fashion or not, but I kind of had to put it in that kind of context for me to see it that way and be able to really get things done. So I don't know how ridiculous it sounded or anything when I put in the stories. That's kind of, it was a necessary tool for years and years to make things happen.
Well, I don't think it was ridiculous. I think that it was, you know, very clear that, you know, a lot of times when someone who's looking to get into anything, you know, any kind of business, but, you know, particularly comics, they'll look to someone who has, you know, had a measure of success and say, well, how do I do it? How do I go about this? And, you know, the number one answer is, you know, do what you love, follow your dreams, and just write or just draw. And, you know, you kind of took it a step further with, you know, no, you've got to sit down and train yourself. What was the quote you cited? You know, I sit down and wait for inspiration, and luckily inspiration strikes every morning at 9 o'clock.
It was Somerset Maugham. It was asked if he writes on a schedule, mm-hmm. On a regular basis, or only when inspiration strikes. He says, I write only when inspiration strikes. Fortunately, it strikes every day at 9 a.m. sharp.
Yeah, that's right. Right.
And it's that kind of idea, you know, the idea that, you know, we perceive art to be free-flowing and, you know, the muse out there. But really, there's a discipline to it that, you know, one has to have as well. And I think laying it out in those terms...
Yeah, that's a really good point. I've been, you know, working in some creative capacity for my living for, you know, probably about almost 20 mm-hmm. years. And so in that time, I've seen a lot of people who are way more talented than I am, who have a natural gift for writing and drawing and are really incredible at what they do, but they often lack a certain discipline or mm-hmm. or ambition or focus or have this idea that it's just, you know, when it's time, it'll just happen, you know, right. Which in a sense is how it's a collaboration, though, you know, you have to work with that time and that happening, right. At the same time, and it's incredible how many people are so talented out there who don't really do it because they think somebody's just going to find them out of the blue without them doing anything and give them the secret handshake and say, right. I know you really haven't done anything except these little things here and there over the last dozen years, but I know that if I give you money and validate you and give you a job, then suddenly you will miraculously make it all happen, and then you'll do it. Mm-hmm. And it almost seems like a lot of people are waiting for some kind of external validation. They're like waiting to get hired before they do any work. It doesn't right. make any sense that way. You kind of do what, you know, just say, what do you want to do? You ask yourself, mm-hmm. what do you want to do? And then if you have an answer, just do it. And then once you do it, then you show it to people. You get, I guess there's like three major steps for that, I guess. The first thing is, if you got an answer to that and you know what project you want to do, the first thing is start it. Because a lot of people will figure out what they want to do, but they'll never start it. And the other thing is actually complete it. Mm-hmm. Because some people will start it, but they'll just think it's their lifelong hobby and they'll right. never complete it.
Sure.
So then you complete it. And some people will actually complete it. And then they'll just—it's over. Mm-hmm. So the third thing is you have to show it to people.
Right.
You have to find some kind of system or some kind of way to show it to people. And now, these days, it's easier than ever to do that. You can make a website, a mm-hmm. Facebook, a MySpace page. You can go to conventions. You can be in person, in front of any editor you want. Mm-hmm. You know, you can. It's, you know, and not just comics too. You know, anything. You know, right. any entrepreneurial idea at all. There's a ways to show people what you're doing, and the more momentum you have behind you doing it on your own, and the more examples you have doing it on your own, the more attractive it is to people who, you know, would love to work with you or mm-hmm. you know, or give you some kind of job or something like that. That's probably the biggest you know, lesson to be learned, you know, from my experience is just that, you know, you don't just show like somebody one tiny thing and say, I, you know, you think I'm good enough, you know,
right.
you should like do a body of work. And that also helps you learn what you want out of it yourself, because
mm-hmm.
you don't have somebody, you don't have to pander to what you think is a house style or what you think a certain employer or publisher wants from you. You do exactly what you want on your own completely. And then when it's done, you can offer it as a yes or no proposition.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if that's advice other people give, but that's mm-hmm. advice that has kind of worked for me, you know, with the children's book thing. I just
mm-hmm.
did it first, and then it's like a yes or no, you know.
Yes.
And the same with Kabuki. I just did Kabuki first, you
mm-hmm.
know, and figure out a way to get it to people afterwards. Because it could be confusing if you did it the other way around, too. You might wonder if you're making artistic choices for business reasons or something.
Right.
So
that's interesting.
I like the idea of business. There's nothing wrong with business. And I like the idea of creating things. My preference, though, is to create it exactly what I want for my own reasons first. Then after that part is done, then find a way to a delivery system for people to find it.
Mm.
You know, because if it's... there's a slippery slope in between where you... If you're already working with an editor or something ahead of time, and some people, maybe this is helpful. Maybe it's really good to work with a publisher ahead of time. But you wonder if they say, well, I think we could sell more if this.
Mm-hmm.
Or we could sell more if this. And you might find yourself going, what's not such a bad idea? And it might be a good idea even for the story, but you're not sure. You're not sure if you're just making that choice for a business reason.
Yeah, that's... interesting, because I wanted to ask you about that. I mean, The Alchemy was published under the Icon imprint at Marvel, which is, you know, the first time that Kabuki has had, you know, such a major publisher. You know, on the one hand, I'm sure it got Kabuki into the, you know, at least the I don't know, knowledge base of more people, because it got a front of previews spot. But how was that working with Marvel in that capacity? You know, because it's a much larger... I mean, it's a corporation as opposed to self-publishing or a, you know, smaller one. So
that's an interesting question. Creatively, no change whatsoever.
Mm-hmm.
Functionally, the people I dealt with about it on issue basis were the production team. Jeff Youngquist, Jennifer Grunewald, were like the editors, where I would send it to them and they would send me a proof and a printer proof, and that was basically my interaction with Marvel for each
mm-hmm.
Issue. Jeff Youngquist, Mark Beasley, Jen Grunewald, just, you know, they would send me some emails and say, hey, does this look like it's scanned and printed correctly?
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, I would go through every page by page, and we'd say, well, this is cutting off this bleed, or this is cutting off that, or this page is upside down, or all these little things you just
right.
have to check.
Right.
And I had to do that previous to Marvel also, but they were a well-oiled machine. They were really very functional and efficient at doing that. But that's pretty much the extent of the change
mm-hmm.
for me. You know, before it was with Image Comics, which was also in the front of the previous
right.
catalog, and that was a big change for
mm-hmm.
the retailers to suddenly see it in the front of the catalog. And then it was with Marvel, where I think Marvel has its own little booklet
right.
inside the catalog. And that was helpful in that I had, right before The Alchemy had come out, I had done, you know, probably like 5 or 6 years of work at Marvel.
Right.
So there was a Marvel audience that was a little bit more familiar with what I had done based on writing Daredevil and working on Daredevil and Alias covers and a few other things, who now suddenly it's in the Marvel catalog.
Mm-hmm.
And it kind of makes, I don't know why it works this way, but somehow it does kind of make sense that, though, okay, you know, that's, we know this guy from this, and we might as well
try
and order this
yeah.
book too. Yeah, it was a good
mm-hmm.
it was a good port of entry
mm-hmm.
for a lot of those readers at Marvel who had become, you know, followers of my work on the Daredevil stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, well, you know, I've seen him write and draw Daredevil, and he's writing and drawing this, you know, give it a shot. So I think it did help it out. That was pretty effective.
On that same note, how much control do you have on, like, when the trade comes out? I mean, this is a gorgeous book. Like, who makes the decision of whether they make it a hardbound book or a softcover or how that comes about.
I made my list of exactly what I wanted, and then I sent it to David Gabriel, is the other guy at Marble that I deal with, who does like the marketing, and I say, here's what I want from this. Can we afford to do this? And then he runs the spreadsheet on it based on what all the extra printing, you know, all the bells and whistles I went for the hardcover, if I could still print it without losing money. And he says, okay, yeah, you can do this. And then so I just send them, you know, here's how I want the spine. Because I do have six volumes previous to this, so I still wanted it to have an identity with those.
Mm-hmm.
So I had a basic template I was able to use, but, you know, so then I said, yeah, I want the spine embossment in gold like this, and I want the front cover embossment like this, and we want a watermark in the inside page and a gold ribbon, and this pound of paper is what I'd like. And they'd say, well, that kind of paper is out of stock, but there's this pound of paper, and we think it's even better, but we can get that instead. And then we'll see how it prints on that paper. And it sounds ridiculous, but yeah, there was many steps just to make sure that we could afford to do it that way,
sure.
And that it would print in the proper paper the way I wanted it to. And the paper that it printed on, the art actually looks way better than the individual issues, just because of the stock of paper.
Mm-hmm.
It holds the ink better, and it shows everything well. And I'm really happy that they were able to make it that way. And the same with the dust jacket. You know, I'd say, here's the dust jacket. Here's how I want it. I make up little mock-ups for the whole thing. I make up my own hardcover mock-up and my own dust jacket mock-up, and I send that to Marvel, and they forward that to the printer for them to use as a guide. And then, you know, it was a pretty meticulous process, and I would have to go through every single page to make sure everything was printed properly. But so far, very, very happy with it. So far as I could tell, it seems like it printed exactly the way that we wanted it to.
Yeah, it's a great book. And then what about the back matter? Because this is one of the best examples of extra material for a trade that I've ever seen. I really love all the letters in there, and then your original scripts with scribbles all over it, and, you know, crossing stuff out and stuff. So did you just ask for that, and then it was the same process? They ran it through the spreadsheet?
Yeah,
type thing.
I said, you know, here's how many pages. It's 9 issues, and most Marvel books are probably, what are they, like 20 pages, I think.
Mm-hmm.
But most of the Kabuki individuals are like 26 or 28 page stories. So I knew it was, and 9 issues already going to be way bigger than probably regular Marvel collection. And I wanted to add extra stuff. So this one is 320 pages. And I just, yeah, I said, hey, well, we want to do all that at 320 pages. Can we make that work? And I was really happy to have the room to add that.
Mm-hmm.
Because it was fun to have the extra scripts, because people ask that. They ask that about the process. You know, here's the finished version. You know, how do you start? What's your script look like? And as you can see in there, it's a fairly full script, you know, typed out. But once I start drawing it, I will start making a lot of notes to myself on the script, and I'll start saying, this scene needs to be before this scene. I need to change these now,
uh-huh.
and I need to move these around. I'm going to cut all these words, and I'm going to add these words, and I start writing them, handwriting them directly on the script, often in different colored ink, so I know what I'm talking about. And I was really happy to. It's the first time I've ever included a best of letters section. You know, each of the issues, I felt like the letters were a big part of each issue, because, you know, like I said, after each chapter, people have time to think about it and speculate and project what's happening. And they'll send me a lot of letters about that. I really like what happened to this, and I think Akemi, I think this is what Akemi is really up to, or I think, you know, this is going to happen. And it was, so I had tons of letters that I'd published before, and I had a lot of new ones that hadn't been published yet. And I looked at the Powers, Brian Bendis's and Mike Oeming's Powers hardcover from Icon, just to see, like, hey, here's the most recent, you know, Icon collection and Powers, and, you know, what do I have to work with here? And I noticed in that they had 20 pages of letters column. And I thought, wow, cool. Well, I'll do 20 pages of letters column. So I used that as a template, because I could have done, you know, 100 pages of letters column, but
right.
on my own, I would have thought maybe 20 pages might seem excessive, but I was like, oh, they got 20 pages in Powers. I'm going to use 20 then. It seems people seem to enjoy it.
Yeah, sure.
So I put 20 pages of letters, responses in the back there. And I like it, because whatever interpretation you have of the book and whatever kind of enjoyment you get from it is your own. But then you can read and you can go, wow, this person saw something completely, you know, look at this little detail they saw that hadn't occurred to me, or this person is seeing this in it, or they're relating and connecting for this reason. And I feel like it's interesting to give you like just a different, all these readers giving you different possibilities of how to look at something in the story, you know, maybe cracking little bits of a code here and there.
Sure, it was really cool to read through that after reading the book. Mm-hmm.
And then the Shy Creatures, I was able to put the Shy Creatures cover and art in the back of it.
Mm-hmm.
And I was really happy. I'm really happy with the whole production. I think Marvel did a super job on it, on the production values.
Yeah, it's a great book.
I am happy to hear that. It represents a chunk of my life. And I'm so, so satisfying to finally have it in one collection.
So, I mean, I think that it brings up the question then, you know, is this the final note on Kabuki? I mean, you've got a resolution to the external conflict, like you were talking about. That gets resolved, basically, in this book. But is this it? I mean, are you done with the Kabuki story? I mean, one of the things I noticed was, you know, was that a pregnant stomach at the end where she's looking down, and, you know, does that bring us back to the circle where the daughter becomes the mother? You know, so have we closed the circle, or is there something more rattling around there?
Well, there's definitely more rattling. Mm-hmm. I do have other Kabuki stories that I had outlined already that I have the possibility of doing. But each of these Kabuki volumes is like such an immersive process that after I finish one, it's such a great piece of closure to have it done. And it was the same way with the first volume, right, with Circle Blood. When I finished it, I had so much more planned, but it was so much work and so immersive and as wonderful as it was, once I finished it, I kind of thought like, well, I could just end it here too if I want. You know, I have all these outlines for the future stories, and I can do that if I want to. But I'm just, you know, I'm going to do some other projects before I start another one. I could just end it right here, and I think that's where I'm at right now. I have some other projects lined up. I feel like I have a big enough body of work of Kabuki that I could leave this as the closing statement on it. Mm-hmm. And at the moment, it feels like it would be enough for me. And I have a lot of other creator-owned projects and other projects lined up that I want to jump onto, and probably I'm not completely objective about it right now. So once I do these, I have some other creator-owned works I've been thinking about for a while that I think it's time to do these before I even think about doing another Kabuki project. And after I do those, then maybe I'll have a clearer idea of, did this say everything I wanted to say? And is it better? That's an interesting question. Even though I have more ideas for it and more stories, is it better just to leave it on a high note? You know, or if I can't escape them and they're constantly there, then you know that if you can't ignore them, then you know you have to do them.
So what do you have lined up? Or what is David Mack's immediate future?
The next project that I'll write and draw is a creator-owned project, and I haven't like announced it anywhere yet. I've just sort of been like working on it piece by piece for a while. But the next thing that'll come out for me is I've got a few projects at Marvel right now. The first one that will come out is, you might have heard this Philip K. Dick adaptation I'm doing at Marvel Comics. It's called Electric Ant, and the first issue will come out this summer. And I was working with the Philip K. Dick estate on this, and we were both on the same page about it, and I asked them if I could, and they had some really good offers from other publishers, but I asked them if I could introduce it to Marvel and offer Marvel to publish it. So it was kind of a fun project in that we were working on it all already together, and then I was able to kind of offer it to Marvel and kind of bring the Dick Estate and Marvel Comics together to kind of see if they could work it out and make it work, and they made it work, and that's going to be a really fun project. And I have some other writing projects for Marvel that haven't been announced yet, and I'm more children's books. I have some more children's books I'm in the works on too.
Wow, busy slate.
it's gonna be really fun.
Do you have any desire, because you have done a little bit on Daredevil, do you have any desire to go back to any of those, either Marvel or DC, you know, already established characters, or are you only wanting to do creator-owned work from here on out?
Well, the way I like the way I've been doing it, like with Kabuki, I'll do like a volume of Kabuki, and then just to flex some completely different muscles, I would do like a Marvel project before doing then even issue by issue on the Alchemy. I would do an issue of the Alchemy, and because each issue was kind of its own thing,
mm-hmm.
before I used to in Kabuki go immediately into the next issue, and on the Alchemy, I did an issue and then I stopped and I did some, you know, covers for Marvel, or I wrote a story, or I did some other projects before going to the next issue. And it really helps me clear the slate, like get a fresh perspective and like feel like I'm rebooting, you know, the system. So I'm operating fresh each time. And I think I kind of like that idea, especially if it's a bigger project. You know, once I finish a big project, you know, do like a really fun, you know, Marvel project or write something, you know, that someone else is drawing, and mm-hmm. work on a collaborative project, and then go back to a project that I do entirely. I like the idea that comic books are it's such a fertile medium,
mm-hmm.
and I like the idea that I can do some where I'm working completely on my own, and I like the idea that I can collaborate, you know, with other people on other ones. So I want to keep that wide open and keep doing that. It's so much fun. You know, when you're working completely on your own, it's really fun, but then you can't wait to work with somebody else.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
And
yeah.
then you get that fix, and then you're like, oh, that was great. Now it's going to be really fun just to, you know, do this on my own. But, you know, often with comics, it can be a really singular exercise. So anytime you have the opportunity to involve more people and collaborate with people that you enjoy, I'll try to do that and take advantage of that, because it's, you know, it's fun. You know, you don't want to get cut off from humanity, like when you're just writing and drawing a
sure.
book, you know,
mm-hmm.
forever. So it's really fun to like riff with people and go back and forth on ideas. There's another, I'm co-writing a Daredevil story called Daredevil End of Days. I'm co-writing with Brian Bendis, and the artists on it are Bill Sienkiewicz and Klaus Janson and Alex Maleev.
Oh, wow.
And each of those guys are guys that have devoted large chunks of their career to Daredevil.
Uh-huh.
And so it's really fun, like, to all riff together and work on this project and, you know, see what's
sure.
coming in. And the art is, it's almost like a love letter to the whole Daredevil mythos. So there's times where, you know, Bill Sienkiewicz will do something painted, and then other times where Klaus Janson will ink Sienkiewicz, and then the most recent stuff has been Klaus penciling and Sienkiewicz inking, and there'll be parts where I'll do some segments painted, and there'll be parts where Alex Maleev will do his style, and it'll have all these different little stylistic eras of Daredevil in the story.
That sounds cool. And so that's going to be like a mini, or...
It's getting longer than the, it might be 10 or 12 issues by the time we're through.
Wow.
That's totally true. Like, they're still, we just got a new issue in from the artists. And then the way we would work on it is Brian and I would have a conversation about something. We'd go like, hey, what about this? What about this? And it's really fun just to have a conversation with another person. And then like immediately the outline of the story just spontaneously happens from a conversation. That's a really fun experience, especially if you're used to working alone. It's just using a completely different part, you know,
mm-hmm.
of your mind. And then we'll have that kind of conversation, and then, you know, I'll go off and I'll write what I think is a full script based on that, and I'll send that to Brian. You know, it's all paneled, it's all, you know, all numbered and everything, and then he'll take that and he'll kind of direct it a little bit more, and he'll put his tweaks on it, and he'll add his changes, and like, well, I want this to be this way, and this kind of the back and forth. It's a really fun collaborative exercise that way.
That sounds pretty cool.
So, you know, it's rare that we get an opportunity to actually sit down and talk with a creator whose work we've already gone and discussed, and you've mentioned that you listened to the podcast. Was there anything in the podcast that stood out to you, like we were way off base, or something that stuck out for you going, oh, I want to, you know, tell them about this? Is there anything that
yeah.
kind of stuck out for you, or
not that you were way off base or anything? I really enjoyed that discussion about stuff, and even when you said, hey, here's this part about the water molecules, I'm not sure you know, how much, you know, I buy that. But mm-hmm. the point of it in the story, that, you know, I get that.
Right.
And I kind of like that, too, because, you know, each of the characters are, like, telling... Akemi even has an agenda. So sometimes when she talks about Edward Devere, you know, you don't know if... does she completely believe that? Is it true? Is it not true? Does she think it's true? Mm-hmm. Or is that just part of her... story to make a point to Kabuki to convince her of something. Mm-hmm. So there's moments like that where, you know, the metaphorical truth of it is the main thing in the story. Not so much that I'm personally, you know, espousing right. all the beliefs into it, but I think it makes a good story.
Yeah.
But one thing that you mentioned in the podcast that I get a kick out of was that you, in talking about that and talking mm-hmm. about the Emoto thing and how you treat children with your background as a teacher, seeing mm-hmm. how that has an effect. You know, my mother was a first grade teacher,
mm-hmm.
so I grew, you know, as a kid, I grew up seeing her her communication to teachers was a communication of teaching and learning, and it was very interesting to me how she talked with them and mm-hmm. and how it was all positive reinforcement. And how she was always focusing on the things that they could do and, mm-hmm. you know, not the things that they could not do. Because I think if you focus on the things they cannot do, they start to think that's real. Right. And if you focus on whatever you focus on, that's what they start to believe in. And she would often make, probably my first experience with art was her making things out of various materials as communicative lesson plans for her students. So... My mother is probably the biggest artistic influence on me in that when I was a little kid, you know, just as long as from, you know, she was already teaching. So from, you know, 1, 2, 3 years old, mm-hmm. I was surrounded by all these art materials, you know, that mm-hmm. she used for her class, you know, clay and staplers and construction paper and glue and markers and watercolor trays. And I had access to that, and mm-hmm. I used all those things, and I still use those little kitty watercolor trays today, you know, that she uh-huh. used in first grade. But I would see her make something, not so much exactly just for self-expression, but as a means of communication, to deliver a message mm-hmm. to the students to make something click in their own minds. Like, she'd have lesson plans for them to learn their seasons and their colors and, you know, their numbers and, you know, all of these basic things, which... I kind of think I, without even thinking about it, just in my formative years, absorbed as a way of telling sequential art, you know, as this kind of using all these things as a communication device that they're not completed until the other person completes them in their mind. You know, they're set up, they're just enough for something to click and for them to put it together. And the principles I learned from watching my mom do that and having immediate hands-on access to materials and just making stuff without thinking about it, those principles are things that I still use on a daily basis,
mm-hmm.
you know, these days. And I would see her run into kids that were all grown up, you know, when I was a little kid, and would go, "Hey, you know, Mrs. Mack, you were my first grade teacher," and I learned, and they all had like a great reaction to her. Like, mm-hmm. You could tell they really reacted well to her, that she had like a very positive, proactive, you know, way of teaching. And it just hit the mark when you mentioned that connection in uh-huh. the book. So I think you know, children's books and comics in general are a great delivery system for those kind of ideas, and in the same way that I saw my mother, you know, showing people something and them you seeing it clicking in their head and them absorbing it. I feel like to a degree I would relate to that. Sometimes when people come up to me at a convention, they'll say, "Hey, you know, I read this in this book, mm-hmm. and this effect on me, it made me think about this, or it inspired me, or made me think in a different way." It'll remind me of the same experience I would see of my mother's former students talking to her and say, "Yeah, when you showed this thing, I still think about that today. That's how I remember mm-hmm. this and this." You know, and I'm fascinated with that, and when you mentioned that in the podcast, I don't really think about this much, but I kind of had that a little epiphany about that mm-hmm. of like, you know, oh yeah, that is how it works with children. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that it's a it's something that probably can't be, you know, underemphasized, you know, how important it is to, you know, focus on what they can do and mm-hmm. treat people in a good way, in a positive way, and they react to it well. Which, you know, ultimately is the metaphor of that entire Dr. Emoto, you know, that idea of the water changing the structure to music or to mm-hmm. words or to ideas.
Mm-hmm. And so so your family's been supportive of you and your artistic endeavors, because, you know, a lot of times parents look at, you know, a child drawing and the child may have real talent, but they'll go, well, you need to do something where you can actually, you know, work for a living. So your parents and your family's been supportive of this process for you?
The short answer is yes. You know, I remember my mother, I don't think it was that I had talent, just that I had a passion to do it. I just enjoyed doing it.
Mm-hmm.
And when you enjoy something, you tend to do it a lot. And if you do it a lot, you hopefully tend to improve at it. And I would show all these things that I would make to my mother, and probably most of it she didn't understand, you know. And she might even say, you know, she would prefer some wildlife drawings or some flowers or something like that. So when I would make a gift for my mother when I was younger, mm-hmm. I would draw for her wildlife or mm-hmm. you know, flowers or something like that for her.
Right.
But I think she still appreciated that I was doing something constructive.
Mm-hmm.
The other way to look at that is that I did a lot of stuff when I was a kid, uh-huh. all kinds of things. But the things that I got the most positive reinforcement for were things that my mother would consider constructive. So even if she had no idea what kind of science fiction-based spaceship or, you know, war scene I was drawing, and even if she didn't like anything with guns or violence or something, and when I was a kid, I was still, you know, drawing people shooting each other and killing each other and, sure. you know, all this stuff. I don't know, you know.
Yeah.
And maybe she probably wasn't comfortable with that to a certain degree, but she probably, in her mind, it probably still fit under the idea of doing something constructive.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas, you know, I did a lot of other stuff that she thought was a lot more dangerous that I would get negative reinforcement for.
Mm-hmm.
That's an interesting question, you know. If I got positive reinforcement for some of the other things I did, mm-hmm. I might have went that direction instead. So I think that plays a big part. At a certain point in my life, I got it in my mind that I wanted to be a stuntman when I was a kid. when I would jump out of a moving car when my mom was driving, and I would jump out of the car. See, because I took it very seriously, my training. she would not give me positive reinforcement for it, nor the rest of the public. You know, my brother and I would put all our soccer shin guards all over our bodies and fill our clothes with pillows, and then we put like a mattress out on the ground and we climb up the roof and jump off the roof, you know, jump from roof to roof. We did all that. We took our stuntman training very seriously, the same way we did our, you know, whatever we were doing.
Right.
But no positive reinforcement for that whatsoever. You know? So I do wonder if the certain things that I had a passion for in retrospect, if those were cultivated, you wonder, oh, I could be doing something totally different. But just repeated, you know, you get the sense that they're not comfortable with you doing this. You, even if you're not consciously thinking about it, you probably change your behavior.
Yeah. The jump. How old were you when you were jumping out of cars? And
yeah, we were pretty young. Yeah, we were probably. I remember the house. There was this one house where there was on the driveway, there was a porch that lined to the driveway.
Uh-huh.
And anytime we would drive by that porch, I loved the idea. It was like 5 feet from the driveway. That I would jump from the car to the... That was like 9 or 10, that house. And so she would just be not thinking anything, and I would just jump onto the porch, you know, thinking like, I can make it, you know. You jump between the railings. There's like a window of supports on the uh-huh. porch roof that you want to jump between. So it was like, it was good training exercise. And she wasn't feeling my stuntman training the same way.
And it hasn't been applicable in later life then?
No, it has. Yes, I do use it, yeah.
I guess I have a question. Where do you see the future of independent comics going? And do you feel like Alchemy is going to have an influence on that?
Wow, that's an interesting question. The second part, I don't know. I don't... I wouldn't want to be presumptuous that this book has, I don't know what kind of influence it'll have on something as a whole. I do get a lot of feedback from readers who do say it's like inspirational and catalyzing their work, or to, you know, to start, you know, not so the drawing and the various different medias in the work. They'll say, oh, I didn't know I could use this media. It would be okay to. It's almost like a little validation that what they wanted to do is going to be okay.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes, and then other people will talk about the some of the ideas in the story that get them thinking about something, and they'll say it's inspiring. So I do hear that a lot. I hope it is a catalyst for them to really do their own thing. I know that when I was inspired by, you know, giants, you know, of the industry, I love the idea of, you know, when you're standing on their shoulders, you know, which is natural, and building on what they brought to it. I like the idea that, you know, if you can somehow give back to that grammar, you know, too, and add a little twist on what they build on and bring something new to the vocabulary of comics. I like that idea as well, because so many different creators have brought wonderful things to the medium. But sometimes they're held in such high respect and esteem that people often keep repeating the basic template of what they do. And the format is so fertile that there's so many different ways you can do it. You know, you don't have to use the same kind of panel structure every time. You can really change the way that you use storytelling and panel structure just depending on that particular story, the nature of the story, the nature of the character, the ideas of the story, you know, can really inform how the story is told. But as far as, you know, comics today, especially independent comics, it's wide open. You know, you have web comics and, you know, the internet. And, you know, comics for me are like the last pirate medium. You know, you don't have to have a license to make comics. You know, one person can make these and in theory get them out to a large amount of people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, unlike, you know, if you're going to do a radio show, you have to have FCC licensing and approval, and same with television, you have to go through certain channels. If you're going to make a movie, you know, often it costs a lot of money to get, and if you want the right distribution, you've got to have a committee, you know, sign off, you know, on stuff to give you money. Whereas right now, comics are, you can pretty much, one person could pretty much say or do anything they want in one comic, and you can find a delivery system for it, you know, and you always will be able to, you know, whether it's the web, whether it's print media, you know, animating it, having moving comics, you know, I think is going to happen increasingly as the technology happens. There's just such a wide variety of ways you can do it, you know, and bookstores now, and publishers are a lot more open now to having original graphic novels, even if they're not known as a graphic novel or comic book publisher. So it's kind of, I feel like it's widening. I feel like the mainstream is embracing it to a degree, and the subcultures will always find, you know, those kind of rivers, or those little streams of new ways to deliver their work.
It feels like it's starting to reach a level of legitimacy where for a really long time it was viewed as just material for children, and then beyond that, it was just superhero books. But I think really with the recent media attention to The Watchmen, it's really creating this interest in it as its own art form that isn't literature or art. And so I really hope, and I think that Kabuki as a whole, and Alchemy especially, really contributes to that. And I hope that there's a lot of attention focused on that.
Well, It's hard to argue with you about, you know, the mainstream embracing it now. You know, New York Times bestsellers list just opened up a new graphic novel section.
Oh, really? Yep.
Yeah, in fact, the week that Alchemy came out was the first week that they started a graphic novel section. And so I'm so glad it came out that week, because it debuted on the New York Times bestsellers list.
Oh,
you know, wow. With Watchmen number one.
It's fantastic. And it's great to get that kind of mainstream recognition, and for you and for the art form.
Yeah, it's an active statement to the art form that, yeah, you're part of the literary you know, you're recognized. Mm-hmm. You know, you deserve your own list on this. So that's a great way to, you know, to recognize it, mm-hmm. and let people know that, you know, it's hard to argue with that idea, that it certainly validates, you know, there's a mainstream validation for it.
Cool. All right. Well, thank you, David Mount.
Thank you very much.
Oh, thanks so much.
I appreciate it. And you've been listening to Stumptown Trade Review.